This is 90.1 WABE. I'm Amy Kiley. The AJC Decatur Book Festival kicks off tomorrow with a panel called Journalism in Our Current Environment. Public radio host and author Brooke Gladstone will participate. Her new book is called The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. I asked her about the book, starting with its title.
That was meant in two ways, that reality is a problem and there's a problem with reality, meaning that reality is a complicated issue, not a straightforward one. It means something different for every person because we each construct our own based on our values and our background and our history and our culture and a whole bunch of other things. And facts don't determine reality. They're an element in it, but they have to be marinated in all those other things before we cook up a reality for ourselves. So that's the trouble with reality, that it's such a sticky wicket. And there's also the fact that reality is in trouble because people are feeling so confused and so unmoored by our current time.
How do we even know what is fact and what is fake?
We do know facts. We can go to good, reliable sources. We can examine how they determine what is what. It's how we assemble them where we get into problems. And of course, there are things that we simply choose to ignore or even to deny if it conflicts directly with the view of the world that we've constructed for ourselves, because it's painful to tinker with your reality. You know, you could break it.
And you write that President Trump put a half Nelson chokehold on reality. How did he do that?
I'm not blaming Trump for our reality being screwed up. It's always been somewhat screwed up, but he took advantage of situations that are baked into human beings. Our ability to function in the world depends on filtering out things. And he was able to encourage people to continue doing that by driving home the idea with every lie that he speaks that a fact is a choice. He empowers you to basically deny what it is you choose not to believe, not to cope with it, not to reckon with it, simply to argue that it doesn't exist. And he does this by taking the engines of accountability that we've always relied on, organizations that assemble data, whether it's the Environmental Protection Agency or the Centers for Disease Control, or most importantly, the media, and simply saying that every single one of those bodies has a political agenda that overrides all the work they do. And therefore, the information they provide is a lie. The truth itself is a liar.
Our listeners have heard NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson fact check President Trump over and over and over again. Given what you just said, is all that fact checking just futile?
Fact-checking is never futile. It is essential in order to create an informed electorate. The crucial thing is to place those facts into a context that is meaningful for the listener. You may hear a fact and it'll prove that Donald Trump is a liar, right? But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it has no effect on you. And if you are in agreement with his general worldview. So when you choose a fact to check, you need to present it in a way that is meaningful to a person, that will have an influence, an impact on the way that they live. And that is much harder than simply saying, you know, he said it didn't rain during his inauguration speech, but in fact he did. Here's the weather report. Here's the pictures. Here are the umbrellas. You know, people will say, you know what? All politicians lie, so it doesn't matter if he lies, unless he lies about something that is vitally important to you personally and your family and the world you live in.
nonprofits like public radio aside, you point out that the news is a business and businesses are about making money, not always telling the truth. Are for-profit news organizations distorting reality or facts for profit?
No, and I don't say actually in the book that they lie to make money. What I'm saying is that they emphasize certain things that will appeal to their audiences. There's enormous amount of distortion that goes on in some precincts of the media, but the media, it's a plural. It's not a unitary institution. You can't put the New York Times and Breitbart and National Public Radio and Fox News in the same basket and call it the media. You need to be honest with yourself and really determine, based on the work that they've done, the important work they've done, and how they deal with the mistakes they make, how they own up to them. What is their process? Do they let you in? You have to find the media that are far less likely to distort or to omit, or that don't do it on purpose. I mean, there are still journalistic values, principally fairness and accuracy. And whether or not it's an advocacy newspaper, they can still be fair and accurate. Places with a point of view can produce really good information. Places without a point of view can certainly produce bad information. I would say that this media environment provides the best and the worst information that we've ever had in American history.
Your book touches on stereotypes in a way that seems to speak to the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. One, how do stereotypes factor into this perspective of reality that you're trying to lay out? And in your book, you argue that President Trump used and even kind of freed, I think, this prejudice toward a list of groups. And how did he use those stereotypes?
Stereotypes are shortcuts that we use. Walter Lippmann, a famous social critic and newspaper man back in the 20s, wrote a book called Public Opinion, which is brilliant. You know, essentially, he was the first person to use the word stereotypes in the modern sense. What he's saying is that we will use a shortcut by taking a single characteristic about a person or a group and then kind of fill in the rest of the blanks and assume that we know them. Oh, they're from Baton Rouge. That tells us all we need to know. Oh, they're from Brooklyn. Oh, they're an investment banker. They're a kindergarten teacher. They're black. They're white. And so on. These kinds of things stand in for a whole lot more and provides a very monolithic portrait of groups that are rich in detail and are very specific. Now, the way that Trump used them during the campaign was simply to create a view of the world and the way it works that a certain part of the population was inclined to believe. And so he said, you know, you have these problems because there are immigrants taking your job. And this is even when employment is booming in the country, but not in those places that have not been served by their government and have been forgotten, really, by both parties. So these people were disinclined to believe anything that traditional politicians told them anyway. So he said, here, I can explain what your problem is. It's these immigrants, or it's these people of color. Or it's the Jews, you know, and then he'd say, and we have this terrible crime because of these people, even though crime is at historic lows, except for a handful of cities where there's been an uptick. He'll create an environment that is untrue or is not contextualized in order to build this reality that seems to speak to the problems of people who have been ignored by traditional politics.
In a democracy, the reality is the people who bothered to vote elected President Trump. So isn't that just a fact we should all accept as reality?
Oh, sure. People who bothered to vote elected President Trump. And people who decided to stay home or decided to make their vote a statement of morality rather than to use their vote strategically, also enabled the election of Donald Trump, who, as we all know, didn't win the most votes. But given the peculiarities of our electoral college system and the way we apportion votes, he became a minority president.
What would you say to people who did cast those votes and who still support the president and who say, my reality is fine? At the Decatur Book Festival, I know you're hosting a panel on the importance of journalism, the importance of that fact-checking. What do you say to the people who hold, no, the way I see facts, that's just fine for me?
I would say that those people are just like everybody else. You don't want to change your beliefs until you have no choice. So unless or until those people determine that the promises he made won't be fulfilled, unless or until those people decide that the image he reflects is one that they can no longer identify with, they will hold fast to the world that he created, which is one that reflected their sense of injury and grievance. Now, I have to say, and I think it bears repeating, obviously he won by a slender margin. Certainly of the popular vote, he didn't win at all. And it was a relatively slender margin in the electoral system, right? So who was the principal voter for Donald Trump? It was the Mitt Romney voter. It was a person who decided that, you know, maybe they don't agree with his worldview. Maybe they don't care that he plays fast and loose with the facts. He's a Republican and he'll probably keep their taxes down. And that was the thing that they were most interested in. Until and unless those voters decide that perhaps favorable tax rates aren't worth the cost, they won't change their votes either.
Any final words of advice for a public radio listener who does want to know the facts as part of their reality, who's listening to this conversation and thinks, what could I do?
You mean to stay tethered to the facts? I've been in public radio a long time. I have enormous respect for public radio listeners. And the thing that I respect most is that they are engaged in the world, whatever politics they have. And I think, at least the last I looked, about a third of public radio listeners called themselves conservatives. So they're curious enough to listen to a radio network that has been decried by the right as, you know, irretrievably leftist. And, you know, and I applaud them. And I think those who are on the liberal side of the spectrum ought to seek out responsible views that are all around them that don't exactly reflect their own image back at them. I think public radio tries to mix it up with a wide variety of voices, but there are plenty of other places to go. I mean, go to the National Review online or commentary. You may not agree with what they say, but you can read well-reasoned arguments there, and it'll at least help you understand what it is that may have happened that you didn't see coming. I mean, the reason why I wrote this book is because a publisher came to me and said, you know, we really want you to write about this moment because people seem so more upset than they've ever been before. And I have to say, I'm no spring chicken, and I've seen plenty of presidents that people didn't like voted in, and never this level of distress. And I felt that the distress level was much less tied to politics than it was to a sense that the country and, in fact, the world didn't work according to the principles that we thought it did, among them that facts can change people's minds. So what I tried to do in The Trouble with Reality is to describe how it is we construct our worlds and how it was that Trumpism found it not nearly as hard as those of us in our bubbles might have thought it would be to take hold and at least prevail during the election, if not after.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.